Oi, oi, it's your boy, Slacky J, popping in on Wednesday, and we're talking about a very slow week of fights. If I'm honest, fellas, don't get your hopes up too much. There's not an awful lot on this UFC card that redeems it. We did have Moicano versus Tsarukyan, which, banger. And then if that had gone through, and we also had Ricky Simone versus Song Yadong on this card, I think I'd be a pretty happy man. You know, I could get a good 40 minutes out of 20 minutes on both those matches. Probably, well, actually, that's a bit of an exaggeration because I'm not going to do 20 minutes on Ricky Simone versus Song Yadong today. But those are two good fights. You know, unfortunately, things fall through. This is always the case, but I do feel like you improve your chances of the event still being good if you make it so that there's a lot of good fights on there. So if you lose one, you've still got some other stuff going on. There's a couple of things on here going on, but some of these are going to be, you know, one's for the nerds, and then there's a couple on there. There's a lot of Contender Series filler on here is what I'd say. Otherwise, this week, there's a crush card with a super lightweight tournament, but I don't think anyone particularly elite is in it. You know, J-Kick, not my wheelhouse. I'm still trying to learn, but from what I could see, not. It was sort of like, well, there's this glory heavyweight tournament too, but it was sort of one of those auxiliary tournaments. If there's a tournament in Crush, it's probably not going to be the Super Elite because they all turn up, you know, they're all under the same banner, the Crush banner, and they turn up in the K1 tournaments when they do a K1 event, you know, a K1 Grand Prix every 3-4 months or whatever it is. There's some not so interesting boxing between Zepeda and Arboleda, but next big boxing things are in the start of May. Cinco de Mayo weekend, obviously. Canelo fights. And aside from that, shoot boxing's back. But shoot boxing is, it interests me a lot, but it is such a niche sport and it's really hard to watch. Like, as in, it's hard to get a hold of. It's kind of like the Ryzen thing. Ryzen now is on Fight TV, I believe, which is a service that you have to sign up for, but then you can buy one-off events and so on. And it's just a pain in the ass to have to keep signing up for things, if I'm honest. Whereas signing up for a Beamer, while it is a tedious process, you know, you have to get VPN, and you have to go around it. Well, you have to get a VPN and do it through your phone. Some people have to, but you get Crush, K1, Rise, basically all the kickboxing that's on. Whereas shoot boxing is out in the cold. I don't even know how to watch shoot boxing. I was looking into it. Was it Titanon or something like that? You have to get a different service, but shootboxing is quite fun. I mean, it's got a really interesting history. It's pretty old, along with, you know, shooto and things like that. But it's kickboxing, but with standing submissions, which doesn't play into it that much, in that there'll be one submission every card, or there'll be one submission every two cards, something like that. It's how Andy Sauer has, like, a rear naked choke on his kickboxing record. You know, it has these weird rules. And also the traditional long tights, the spats. Before grapplers were wearing spats, shootboxing had dudes in spats, which is why Andy Sauer used to wear the spats, the long tights. And there's been some really good guys come through there. I think Boakao had a couple of fights in shootboxing, and he might have even submitted someone at some point. But obviously the guillotine is a little bit more reasonable. Power guillotines with the full figure four lock, obviously because it's hard to get your wrists under someone's neck if you're wearing boxing gloves. But another guy come through there, Kato Ono, really good, shit-hot fighter. He fights all over the place. He fights in, I think his last fight was in Rise. He's fought in Knockout. I don't think he's ever turned up at K1, but he did fight on The Match 2022, which was the big crossover event. And he fought and beaten Masaaki Noiri, you know, one of my favorite strikers of all time. And he looked really smooth in that fight. They both looked good in that fight. It went to an extra round decision, but you know, that's how smooth this guy is. Throws beautiful combinations, like rapid fire punching combinations, and then he does a pull that he goes onto his back foot. He's quite a tall guy for the weight class. He goes onto his back foot and he keeps his body square to the opponent, but pulls and lets him fall short, and then comes back. He's really good. He'll high kick off people off. He'll do a pull counter with a high kick. But anyway, yes, shoe boxing. Super interested in that. If anyone knows how to steal it, I'd love to know. Or if anyone wants to post it to YouTube and send me private links to that video, I'd be very happy. Yeah, but not a lot to look forward to this week. I know that whenever I say that, people go like, oh, Jack, we'll listen to you talk about anything, blah, blah, blah. Do the video game episode is what everyone always says. I always say I'm going to do like an episode on important video games to me or my favorite games ever or whatever, or maybe even like a fighting game episode, even though I'm trash at fighting games. I have been putting time, or I did put time into Tekken 7. They're advertising Tekken 8 on the UFC, and the release date isn't until 2024. That's mad. Surely advertise Tekken 7, or just do like what Overwatch or people do, or Counter-Strike is doing. Just have Tekken 7 roll on into being Tekken 8 or whatever. But yeah, very weird that they're advertising that already. I suppose it gives you some time to get ready, because I was like, oh my god, they're already doing a Tekken 8. I'm only just getting good at Tekken 7, but it turns out Tekken 7's been out for like 6 years already. It was a PS4 launch title or something. Maybe we'll do something on video games at some point. I do keep promising to do the Sifu playthrough. It's been a long time since I played any Sifu, actually, so I'm probably pretty bad at it. But so this is always the thing. I don't want to do it because people will be like, nice moves, dickhead, because I'm not actually good at video games. I just enjoy playing them. But they brought out a load of DLC for Sifu, which I'm really looking forward to playing. I mean, and in fact, you know, in like a week or two, Legend of Zelda Tears of the Kingdom is going to be out. So I'll be dumping large parts of my life into that, I imagine. And it's on a portable console. So, you know, even more ways to just bury my life into Legend of Zelda. With that being said, I was never really into Legend of Zelda until Breath of the Wild. I played like... I did enjoy Wind Waker, what I played of it, but I played Skyward Sword. And I think I played Majora's Mask. But yeah, I played a couple of them and I wasn't like blown away, but I played them long after they came out. And people were all like, oh, formative experience for me gaming, blah, blah, blah. So I tried them and I'd be like, not my cup of tea. However, I was mad about Okami, which apparently took a lot of inspiration from Zelda and people called it like a Zelda-like. Absolutely loved Okami. I thought it was a brilliant game. Would have loved a sequel to that. But anyway, you know, video game stuff for another time. What can I do? I can talk you through the books I'm currently reading, because there's always a good stack of books next to me when I'm doing these podcasts. I picked up a book called Sumo by Lord K2, which I pre-ordered months ago, but it's a absolutely beautiful series of photographs of sumo training and sumo competition. Nice coffee table book. I'm reading Richard Kim's The Weaponless Warriors, an informal history of Okinawan karate. You know, standard stuff, but he's a guy who went out there and chatted to a lot of the old Okinawan masters and brought back some cool stories. Also, a really influential guy because he trained Patrick McCarthy, who is one of the leading historians on Okinawan martial arts and so on. Patrick McCarthy being the guy who did the most respected translation of the Bubishi. There's been a couple. I own about three different translations of the Bubishi, but Patrick McCarthy's one is probably the most scholarly, I would say. There's a lot of footnotes and a lot of explaining the various meanings that phrases can have and so on, you know, how they're sort of lost in translation, things like that. And it's got all these essays in it too, you know, because a lot of the Bubishi is a waste of time, really. It's I don't know if it was a waste of time in Okinawa. Sorry, if you don't know what I mean by the Bubishi, we're going into weird martial arts shit on this episode. I'm sorry, but the Bubishi is something I've written quite a bit about, Fightland and so on. But it was a martial arts text that came from Fujian, China, I believe Fujian, China, and made its way to Okinawa, where karate, obviously, or Tei, as it was, and then became karate, or Tode, and then Tei, and then karate. But Okinawan martial arts, proud history, weaponless kingdom, so martial arts were a big thing, particularly with the poor people, and particularly with the elite classes. Obviously, there were some really interesting theories people had, because it's literally no swords. So the very rich could practice kendo and so on, but it meant that like the king's bodyguards couldn't have swords. So they really valued martial arts prowess with things that weren't bladed weapons. So a lot of karate history is focused on a guy called Sokon Bushi Matsumura, who was the king's bodyguard for three different kings. He was a bodyguard into pretty old age. So probably gets taken down and easily submitted by Demetrius Johnson. I'm not saying he isn't, but really interesting and formulative character in martial arts. Anyway, what were we saying? Oh, sorry, yes. So a copy of this book, The Babishi, made its way from China to Okinawa because there were a lot of... there was a lot of clever ways that the Okinawans went to the Chinese mainland and trained martial arts there and came back, because martial arts were trained largely in secret in Okinawa. And of course, you know, there's a myriad of reasons to travel to China. So you got people like Kanbun Uechi, the founder of Uechi Ryu, which I believe came from a form of tiger boxing in Fujian. He goes out there for some kind of job opportunity and ends up training there. But there's other guys who go there on diplomatic missions. And one of the most famous characters in Okinawan martial arts history is a guy called Kosukun. And he's a Chinese ambassador who comes to Okinawa, and he brings them a load of martial arts and stuff. But the Babishi is a thing that escaped mainland China, got to Okinawa, and guys copied it by hand from teacher to student. So you got a lot of, like, lost stuff there, because if you copy it by hand, it's not going to be exactly the same. And a huge amount of it is to do with basically, like, brewing potions. So it's all about these plants and things and their herbalistic uses. But it's still a decent distance from Okinawa to the eastern coast of China. So I doubt they've got the same plants, or, you know, exactly the same plants. So you've got to wonder, like, when they were copying this shit, were they like, this is useless, why don't I just copy the fighting section? Anyway, spent too long on that. I got a book called Qin Na Fa, The Art of Seizing and Grappling, which is by Liu Jin Sheng, and it's an old book. It's 1936. I've used it in articles before. It was for a police academy in Zhejiang province, and Qin Na is the art of seizing and grappling. So there's a lot of, like, classical Japanese jiu-jitsu stuff in there, you know, the familiar standing arm lock over your bicep and so on. But there's also a lot of, like, what I like about Qin Na is that it's just grabbing people on shit that hurts. You know how, like, pushing your fingers into the sternal notch or whatever it's called. Someone told me what it was the other day. The hollow at the base of your neck. If you push your fingers in there, it's fucking rough. And if you do that to someone while you're rolling with them, firstly, they'll hate you and they might punch you. But it will make them move. And Qin Na is kind of like that. You're just doing things that the other guy's like, oh, fuck off. And it links in with there's a book called Kill or Get Killed by Rex Applegate, which I'm sure my American listeners will love, because there's huge sections on, like, shooting and prepperism. But he was an army colonel who ended up in the police or something like that. And he writes about arresting holds. And he basically tells you what a lot of people doing police training don't. And, you know, this is a book from, like, the 1950s. But he says, like, there is no position that you can physically hold someone against their will indefinitely. They're always going to be squirming, and if they keep squirming, and this is true in, like, jiu-jitsu as well, if someone keeps moving and squirming, it's really hard to keep control of them. Even if you've got, like, a shit-hot mount or something like that, or back mount, really, really hard to keep control of someone for an indefinite amount of time. Obviously, a bit easier if you're pinning them on the ground than if you're trying to arrest them standing up or bending over a table or whatever. So he said that there are really only two types of arrest hold you can use. One, pain arrest holds, where the other person will give up struggling because it hurts, you know, whether that be because you're going to break something or it's just horrible, like a lot of the Qin Na shit. And the humiliation holds. One of them he lists is, like, grab the guy's bottom lip and twist it, which is just fantastic. Or, you know, trouser a guy, pants in America. And those are things where the guy will give up because of the embarrassment, you know, or might give up fighting because of the embarrassment. Or, you know, de-escalate the situation with a little bit of embarrassment. Obviously, you have to pick your situations well, because if you embarrass someone when they're very angry, they might just try and kill you harder. But yeah, Qin Na, really interesting. And this one by Liu Jin Sheng, you can actually find on the internet for free. It's a really fun little book full of interesting things that you can do to fuck with your friends. I'm also reading a book on, it's called Fujian Ground Fighting, The Art and Practice of Ancient Chinese Shaolin Dog-Style Boxing. It's a book from the 70s that's been reprinted. And dog boxing is super interesting. Someone did a video on it recently. Who was it? There's a judo channel on YouTube called Chadi, I believe. And, I find him hit and miss because he's just furious about buggy chokes and things. But he did a video, like, comparing some dog boxing with modern ground fighting. And dog boxing is really interesting because it is one of the older ground fighting arts. You know, judo, the ground fighting came in because they were doing challenge matches, dojo to dojo. And one school of jiu-jitsu, they just said, get on the ground. They can't do anything to you there because they got really good throws, but they can't do anything to you on the ground. And then Kano went back and said, shit, we better do some fucking Neiwaza. But I believe dog boxing is older than, I believe it's older than judo and it's, you know, sort of jiu-jitsu predecessory type age. I'll be honest, I skipped the introduction, so I don't know how old dog boxing is, but it's a lot of putting your back to the mat and kicking the guy in the groin, reaping the leg, which has always been a dangerous thing to do, or people understand that it's a dangerous thing to do to someone in that you can hurt them. There's crab rides and things in there. You know how, not the crab ride of wrestling, which we're all familiar with, where you've got your feet inside their thighs from behind them, but the crab ride of jiu-jitsu where you're on your back and you get around behind someone and have your feet inside their thighs from behind, and then you can start coming up on their back and stuff. There's stuff that Lachlan Giles is very good at. Look up Lachlan Giles at the B team. He does a load of stuff on the crab ride. But yeah, in old ass dog boxing kung fu, the crab ride exists. And the 50-50 and all sorts, you know? I suppose that's no surprise to anyone, but I always find it interesting when you see shit like that, you know, in old sources. The Kimuras in Greek statuary and 50-50 in old wrestling matches and so on. But returning to Kosakun, the important martial arts figure, the Chinese ambassador who ended up in Okinawa, and I believe is referenced in... There's a dispatch from a French agent to Napoleon talking about this bizarre weaponless kingdom, and it mentions Kosakun, and it mentions him, I believe, showing a what we would call now a kanibusame, or something similar. So throwing yourself to the floor with kicks has always been a cool thing in martial arts. Even when you were fighting on sand or, well, not concrete back then, but you know, whatever roads were made out of. Maybe they didn't have roads in Okinawa. I don't actually know. I know that Madagascar, for a very long time, had a modern military and didn't have roads, because the reasoning was that if you build roads and someone invades you, they'll use those roads to get to the capital quickly. And when you say it like that, you go, oh, sound logic, can't disagree. Though, of course, you then can't move your own troops around if someone invades you. And then the other thing that I'm reading at the moment is, oh, I just finished that Last Ronin, the Ninja Turtles graphic novel or series of comics or whatever it was, because people were raving about it because it's just been commissioned for a film or something like that. I thought it was okay. And then I started reading. Having done a load of Berserk, I got tired and I decided to read Akira. Because I watched the film years ago, and I thought, oh. And I thought, that was interesting. I'd like to hear more about that world. And then I found out that, like, Akira is based on book one of a six-book series this guy was going to do. And he got commissioned for the film, or he got it optioned after one. So apparently the actual books have way more in. But I'm reading, I'm halfway through the first book, and I'm really enjoying it. It's really good fun. Highly recommend Akira, the book. I'm going to be one of those guys, you know, oh, the book's much better than the film. Yeah. Also reading a book called Vanished Kingdoms by Norman Davies. I'd read Beneath Another Sky, which is his most recent one. It was all right. Then I read Vanished Kingdoms, and man, that is some slow shit. Just all about these kingdoms that have cropped up and disappeared in Europe. Burgundy. There's been about 12 different places called Burgundy in Europe, or Burgundia. But the man has a very boring writing style. So that's the Slacky's bookshelf report on what's off the bookshelf at the moment and cluttering up the house. Let's chat about some fights. I said let's talk about Gervonta Davis versus Ryan Garcia. What to take away from this fight? I thought, well, Ryan Garcia, obviously famous for the left hook. Very dangerous punch against southpaws, but different. Same, but different is what they say. And this is the thing. There's hooks and there's hooks. There's all kinds of different ways to throw your hook. There's all kinds of different mechanics you could use to throw your hook. When you're throwing your hook against a, you know, whenever there's a slightly not straight punch connected in a, and they show this slow-mo replay, the commentators are talking about how, like, his left hook. There was a point when, like, if a jab dropped someone, they'd say it was a left hook anyway, because a jab would never drop someone in some people's minds. But we talked about it, you know, I think it was Bruce Lee talked about corkscrew hooks. You know, he differentiated. Rather than punching straight, you just bow it out a little bit. So you're still extending your arm at your elbow. You're still thrusting the punch in. You're not bringing it across your body. But it's coming across your body, but on like an arc towards the opponent. And that's the one that's typically very useful against for attacking southpaws, because you can go around their lead hand. You throw a couple of jabs up the center, or you smack them in the lead glove twice, and then you arc it very slightly around. But you've got to be quick, and you've got to set the trap, because you know how straight hitting gets boxers plums. You are throwing around the line of what would be their jab. So you have to be pretty quick and crafty with it. But there are a couple of those. You will see guys like leaping forward with left hooks against from orthodox against southpaws, and it can work. A really good example would be Miguel Cotto versus Sergio Martinez. Stepped inside the lead foot, lunged forward, you know, put his shoulder basically inside of Martinez's shoulder, and winged the left hook almost as an overhand. But there's a lot of scope for that to go wrong. You know, you can off-balance yourself quite badly. And someone asked about it, and I mentioned it the other day, but I was watching a clip of Harold Graham. It was on someone's YouTube channel. He was just giving a little seminar in some local MMA gym, and he was talking about the left hook, and he was saying that you want your hook to be, you want to be sending power in a circle, because you're rotating at the waist and the shoulders, and you're bringing it around. And he said a lot of people throw their left hook and end up, if they miss, they throw themselves off to their right. Whereas you want your weight, your power to be going towards your back leg, where you're nicely based. I thought this was really interesting, because, you know, Harold Graham, not famous for his left hook, did a lot of slapping people with, like, straight arms, because one of the things about straight arm swinging, it's bad, but it's also, once you start fighting good opponents, it's also really weird for them, because the hook is shorter than the jab. But if you straighten your arm and you hit them with, like, the inside of your first knuckle, suddenly you've got a punch coming in from the side that's as long as the jab. Won't have very much power on it if you get your, like, wrist in front of it, that'll block it. But it does confuse people. So if you watch Dominic Cruz doing those weird straight-armed backstepping swings, he catches guys and they're like, what? That shouldn't have caught me. What are you doing? So Harold Graham used to do a lot of that. And he wasn't super famous for his left hook, but I would take on board his advice about guys throwing themselves off to the right, because he made a lot of people miss. He was a master at getting out of the way of punches, or drawing punches and ducking under them. And he made a lot of people fall over, like missing punches. You'll have seen loads of clips of people doing this, throwing the left hook and either getting hit or even knocked out while throwing the left hook, and it just throws them off to their right and they slump onto their hands and knees, or if they've been knocked out, onto their face. So when you're going towards someone with the left hook like that, particularly in the southpaw versus orthodox matchup, because you're reaching out ahead of yourself so much, that can be a real danger. And there were a lot of these left hooks, even when Garcia was standing on place, trying to throw the left hook across himself rather than towards Davis, where he'd miss and he would completely throw himself out of balance. But the early going was a lot of that. There was jab, jab, loopy, hooking jab. And there was also one, two, threes. You know, he was just looking to do what he normally does, which is be wicked fast. And round two, Gervonta Davis just abuses the clinch, which I thought, when I was watching it, I was going, this ref's not really warning him about this very much. Because of the grey rules of boxing. You know, the clinch is as much of a foul as anything else that's in the fouls, but it's also not. I think the wording is like excessive clinching or something like that. But I've never seen someone like Floyd Mayweather, who clinches multiple times in every round, suffer a point deduction. What happens is you get told off and then you get repositioned back in the middle of the ring where you wanted to be in the first place. Gervonta Davis stepped in on Ryan Garcia about four times for the clinch. And then the next time he just hit him with an overhand. It was just a left hand on the chin as Garcia was trying to step in and make stuff happen without letting Davis tie up. The other thing about guys tying up a lot is that you'll see guys, they'll throw their punches and they'll try and stiff arm or like the chest or something like that. And he just got chinned coming in. And that was the sort of moment where he began shelling up. There was a knockdown in round two. And then basically until about round five, Garcia wasn't really doing much. But then neither was Davis. It's very like the odd left straight to the body or whatever. The size disparity was enormous in this one in terms of height. But then Garcia started opening up in round, I think round six, and he actually was looking pretty good. Really liked his right uppercut to the pit of the stomach, but he did get caught off that. He did it twice in a row and then got caught immediately after. But the right uppercut to the pit of the stomach with against the southpaw, always a great shot. I mean, it does obviously leave you naked on that right side where their left hand is always the danger. But love that punch nonetheless, especially stepping around the corner. If you watch someone like Vasily Lomachenko, when he throws his left hook, he like jumps around the opponent's lead foot and then he hammers them with the right uppercut to the midsection as they're pivoting to face him. But yes, it was unfortunate because Garcia, this is the thing, Gervonta Davis, we talked about this in the preview, but Gervonta Davis is a very low output fighter a lot of the time. And when we're talking about his counterpunching, he's a big counterpuncher, but focusing on the big counterpunch. He's not a counter combination hitter. I do want to make a distinction. If he hits you with a good counter and he sees that it's landed well, he might follow up with a combination. But what he doesn't do is throw his hands back in combination, as a reaction. Juan Manuel Marquez is the example I gave the other day, but even like Manny Pacquiao wasn't particularly a counterpuncher. But when he counterpunched, he immediately started throwing his hands in more than one punch at a time. It was always because he was counterpunching to get on offense. It's two different things. You can counterpunch and try and steal the initiative with it and get on offense, or you can counterpunch a combination because you're expecting the first one to not land. If you're fighting someone good, even the counterpunch, they might get their elbow back in time, they might duck down behind their shoulder. But if you throw a combination, you know that they're out of position, so you've got a good chance of landing something. But yes, Davis is very much one at a time. So Garcia working in combinations, it was a sound idea, and he was having success getting on the front foot. But he got hit with one really good punch. It was under the ribs, inside his right arm, as he was, I think he was coming out of a clinch even. But this shot has been analysed ad infinitum this week, because it's just a little digging arm punch. I think it hit him in the liver, and he goes down. And some weirdo was like, an MMA fighter would walk through that. And you're like, when has an MMA fighter ever absorbed a body shot? They just don't do them. But the whole thing about body shots is, one of the reasons that people don't do them enough generally is because you expect the big payoff and you often don't get it. If you hit someone with a really good left hook to the liver and then they no-sell it, you're not going to do it again. So a lot of the power is attritive. If you keep hitting someone in the body, even if they're no-selling it, they're going to start slowing down and feeling it. But the ones that really hurt people, they hurt because they got caught unexpected. You know, to bring it back to wushu bullshit, I think it was Gogen Yamaguchi, the cat, he had a thing, the eight kyo, or moments of weakness, and one of them was breathing in. And that really is generally, like, across all combat sports, if someone does something when you're breathing in, as it impacts you when you're breathing in, it's worse. I've heard of people, like, when they're sparring someone who's breathing hard, only stepping in or cutting the ring or fainting when the opponent's breathing in. People used to say that about Floyd Mayweather. He'd faint on you when he could see you were breathing. Just to disrupt your breathing. It all gets worse and worse and worse. If you're out of position, if you start being asked to work at the worst time in your like breathing cycle, that can tie you out too. But you know, these are minute things that can add up to make a little bit of difference. If you get caught breathing in and hit in the stomach or the liver or the solar plexus, it sucks. It's going to hurt. And you're going to feel like you're going to die. There's that great one of Badr Hari against Alexei Ignashov, the Russian Scorpion. If you've never seen Ignashov fight, go check him out, because he knocked out a young Badr Hari and he knocked out Semi Schilt pretty close to Prime Schilt. But his career sort of spiraled out of control because he had huge alcoholism problems. Really quite a sad character, but amazing talent. In the golden age of heavyweight kickboxing, he was the guy that people just like, man, if Ignashov turns up and he's not drunk, you have a horrible night in store. But he hit Badr Hari with a body shot, and Badr Hari went down, and you could see Badr Hari thought he was going to die. Because Ignashov comes over, and it, like, after the match has been called, the 10 count's given, Ignatov runs over and starts, like, he holds him up and he's holding his elbows, with still with the boxing gloves on, holding his elbows and exaggeratedly making him breathe. But yes, someone shared a load of clips of body shot knockouts in recent boxing matches. And one of them was, one of the Charlo brothers. He fought Rosario. Sorry, Jermell Charlo. Another one where parents named their twins very similar names, Jermell and Jamal. What the fuck are you doing? you're setting yourself up for a life of difficulty as a parent. But Jermell Charlo, he was fighting Rosario and he hits him with a jab. And it, you know, we talk about this quite a lot, but half jabs. He jabs and he brings his hand back halfway. It's still pointing down. And then he pokes it into the body with a level change and a drop of his weight. So there's a bit of power on it, but it's still a half punch. And he catches Rosario in the solar plexus and Rosario goes down like he's died. And the aftermath of the knockout is him freaking out, you know, because he thinks he's going to die from whatever's happened to his body. And it is just, it's getting caught out of position. Now, it's not something you can control as the offensive man, which is why you want to be throwing lots of body shots whenever you can. I mean, you've got a better chance if you do it on the counter, catching someone when they're breathing in or just when they're not ready for it. So counter body shots are always a great weapon, and they're also a great way to start a combination. If you counter with a body punch and come upstairs with the punches afterwards, I mean, that was a huge part of Castamante's philosophy and Mike Tyson's success. But that's about as close as you can get to controlling when someone gets hit out of position with a good body shot. But yeah, I mean, Ryan Garcia went down like a sack of shit. And it was all just speculation over, like, whether he could have got up or whatever. People saying, like, oh, he was smiling. But honestly, like, you know, whether your will is broken by the punch or whether you physically can't stand, it's effectively the same thing, with a body punch particularly. Almost every good body punch you see, the guy takes a knee and he just doesn't get up. And you could always be like, could he have gotten up? Ultimately, it's, academic. But incredible performance by Javonte Davis. Very low output performance by Javonte Davis, but man, the man bangs with his counters. I saw someone post a thing saying, despite being only inches off dwarfism, which is true, he's a very small fighter, but even for that weight class. But man, years ago, they were talking about after Tenshin lost to Mayweather on that Rising card, and they paid Mayweather $10 million for the... two stories about this, actually. They paid Mayweather $10 million to do this and embarrass their homegrown talent. And Ryan Garcia was interviewed about it at some point and someone said, oh, did you see that Mayweather thing? And he said, yeah, what a waste of money. They could have paid me $10 million and I'd have let the guy have a decent fight. And they went, so you want to fight Tenshin Nasukawa? He goes, yeah, the Japanese dude, I'd have given him a decent fight. And that was turned into, like, Ryan Garcia calls out Tenshin Nasukawa. He didn't even know who he was. he just said, I'd have given him a decent fight, the Japanese guy. But yes, then after that, there was talk about doing, because it was Mayweather Promotions and he was under Mayweather Promotions, there was talk about doing Tenshin versus Javonte Davis because the weight would have been closer. And anyone with a brain was like, that's ridiculous. Why are you trying to get Tenshin Nasukawa killed? but I mean, respect to him because he's been on the highlight reel side of a lot of mismatches that have been made deliberately to make him look good, particularly in Rising. You know, in Rise, he would go and smash legitimate top guys. And then in Rising, they'd bring him in some MMA fighter who had no idea what they were doing for a kickboxing match. But Tenshin Nasukawa the other week, and I said I'd talk about this, but I still haven't watched the full fight. I've only been able to find highlights. But he looked really good. He fought the number four bantamweight. Was it bantamweight? The number four guy in his weight class in Japan. And he won, and he looked pretty good doing it. And to be honest, I was kind of expecting this because my skepticism was somewhat BTFO by his jab against Takeru. Because he went into the fight with Takeru and he basically won it on boxing in a kickboxing match. It was really impressive. I mean, you know, Takeru got back into it in round three and it was close. And it was a 9-minute fight. 5 years in the making, I said this on Twitter, but that's a ridiculously small amount of time. I mean, it's positive in some ways, as I've said. You know, if you watch a kickboxing match, it's only 9 minutes, so you've not lost anything if it's bad. But to have the two best guys in the world and have them do 9 minutes of fighting, when you could do it, you could just do five rounds. I believe it's Rise uses five rounds and K1 only does three even. Or is it the other way around? But, you know, technically no belt on the line, but you should have just done five rounds because people wanted five rounds. Anyway, point is, while it's still not really close, Gervonta Davis versus Tenshi Nasukawa is actually considerably closer than it was in a legitimate sense, not in a let's have Tenshin murdered on live TV sense. I mean, he's still got some work to do, but good for him not jumping in with bums. Not quite Lomachenko levels of I will fight for a world title in my first fight, but I don't think that was ever on the cards. Lomachenko was one of the most accomplished amateur boxers of all time and jumped into a title fight, which I'm still surprised that the sanctioning body's allowed, but probably because they make a few quid out of it. But Tenshi Nasukawa was someone who had literally never boxed before professionally. And then all his actual boxing performances were weird exhibitions on Ryzen against MMA fighters like Hideo Takuro, and he didn't even look good in them. I can't remember how I got here. I think I was talking about Tenshin versus Gervonta Davis. But that was it, basically, the fight we needed to talk about from last weekend. I still haven't watched the Gi Grand Prix thing that was going on. Need to sit down and make myself, even though I loathe the Gi. I mean, I'm all right training the Gi. It's like, watching the Gi is just, oh, CBA, mate. So anyway, let's do a quick rundown of this UFC event this weekend. I don't have an awful lot to say, but we got Song Yadong versus Ricky Simone. Ricky Simone, I'm always sort of impressed by him because he clearly likes boxing a lot and he works on it. And he does things that I want to see, slipping and ripping to the body, doubling up off the same hand, throwing body-body head combinations, uses his jab occasionally, throws the uppercut to the chest when he thinks a guy's going to level change, which I absolutely love. Not really a boxing thing, but boxing and MMA, everyone should be throwing the uppercut to the chest when they think their opponent's going to duck in, because if he doesn't duck in, you get an uppercut to the body. If they do duck in, you've got a good chance of smashing them in the head or throat. But he also loves squaring up. He's very available to be hit a lot of the time. Because he wants to slip punches, he's sort of waiting on them. And, famously, Jack Slack called this shot. That he said, the only person in that division, or the best person in that division that Uriah Faber can beat as an old man coming back for one fight is Ricky Simone, and he'll do it by overhand right to the face. And it happened. Splicing the audio of George Foreman winning when they go, it happened! It happened! But yes, that's Ricky Simone in a nutshell. What I like about him is combinations and bodywork into short level changes and, do it. Putting up pace and doing work. His fight with Merab is amazing. No one really knew how good they were going to be at the time because that was back in 2018. And they were both quite new. That was actually Simone's first fight in the UFC and Merab's second. Merab actually started on a 2-fight losing streak. But the pace of that one, both of them just going after it. So if this is 5 rounds, I believe they've changed it to 5 rounds. Sometimes when they put it in a main event, when they bump it up at short notice, it's not 5. No, it's 5 rounds. That's a good thing to have. He's got a style that could make him fodder for Song Yadong, because Song Yadong is a big hitter, big overhands. The one thing that Ricky Simone really does struggle with, power early on is what I'd say. But on the other hand, Song Yadong really good at fighting off takedowns in a singular sense. What he struggles with is when guys, if you saw in his last one, Sandhagen just got him by showing lots, because he'd do a slight dip towards Song Yadong's hips and Song Yadong would go parallel to the floor in a leaping sprawl, and then he'd have to get up again, and it's a lot of work. Song Yadong training at Team Alpha Male, lots of experience with really good wrestlers, can stop a takedown, but what I like about Ricky Simone's style of wrestling in this fight is that he just keeps going for them. It's kind of like Merab. Your level change, if it doesn't work, you're in the clinch, you strike out of the clinch. He's pretty good with elbows, actually. He hit Jack Shaw with a great one just before the sequence that ended the fight. But you duck on the hips, you come up into the clinch, you duck on the hips again, you come up into the clinch, you break with an elbow, you duck on the hips again. That smothering sort of wrestling, I think, is much better suited to getting Song Yadong down or tiring him out and getting on his back than, the one big attempt, which is probably what he's meeting a lot of if he's training with people like Chad Mendes. Not going to be talking about those this week. I'm not covering the Murder Company. I know Chad Mendes is boxing Eddie Alvarez in BKFC, and I know that Luke Rockhold's going against Mike Perry, but no interest in giving them any sort of coverage or exposure. No interest in paying for that event. I don't know if I'll even steal it, to be honest, but as I was saying, so I could see it working out that way, where the chain or at least repeated attempt wrestling wears on Yadong over the rounds, but I could also see it working the other way, where Simone just keeps hitting a brick wall because he's not Corey Sandhagen landing 100 strikes between each fake takedown attempt. He's Ricky Simon, who is pretty much, you know that he wants to throw punches, but he ultimately wants to get on your hips and take you down. He also, like, until the last takedown attempt on Shaw, he was really struggling to get Shaw off his feet. Now, Shaw's a good wrestler for a Welshman, but Song Yadong, I would put in a better class of takedown defense generally, because I saw, you know, Jack Shaw got taken down by Timur Valiyev, who's not an elite wrestler. I mean, he's good at mixing his whole game up, which is as good as being an elite wrestler in MMA. But yeah, so I don't really know what to make of this fight. I mean, if I'm Ricky Simon, I'm getting to the body early and often. I'm calf kicking as much as possible, which he did do a good job of against Jack Shaw. And I'm not trying to take this guy's head off, because that was the conclusion that Sandhagen reached. He was like, why am I trying to take this guy's head off? I'll chop him up with elbows, which, you know, you've got a good chance of knocking someone out with an elbow, but if you don't, at least you cut him. What I don't want to be seeing is Ricky Simon just swinging overhands and left hooks and things. Yeah, there's so much more. You've got better targets and you've got a better chance of taking him out over the distance if you just keep it below his neck. I mean, obviously not ignoring his head. You want to throw his head so that you can get the opportunities on the body and the legs, but I don't want to see him, like, focusing on the head. I'd be interested to see Ricky Simon pick up some clinch striking. I've seen Yadong do a bit of decent clinch striking. Simone had a good elbow on the exit, as I said, against Shaw, but because he gets those clinches so often from the short level change and being pulled up, he gets into the over-under along the fence. I'd love to see him start working some clinch striking more effectively, but it just doesn't seem to be part of his game that much at the moment. The co-main event is Caio Baraglio versus Mikhail Oleksijuk. Oleksijuk coming off the knockout of, I think it was Cody Brundage in his last one, who is the fight before him on this card. And Caio Baraglio coming off a fairly dull decision win over Muradov. Before that, a fairly dull decision win over Petrosian. And before that, a technical decision win over, oh my God, Ziev. I enjoyed him enormously on the Contender Series against Jesse Murray. I really liked his striking there, but it seems like he's not as confident striking generally. I thought he was sort of a minimalist Machida-style striker, but it seems like he just doesn't like to strike a lot. On the ground, he's good, good fun for me as a nerd, because he hits giggler sweeps and things. That crew, what are they called? The Fighting Nerds. They had Mika Galvao's team training with them before ADCC for quite a while. What are they called? Can't remember what they're called, but it's Diego Reyes, who I think won his category, Baby Shark. Mika Galvao, who was, doing amazing things in jiu-jitsu. And I think they had Damien Meyer there as well. But, yeah, really good camp of BJJ killers were hanging out with them for quite a while. So they take it serious down there. I mean, the Mika Galvao camp wouldn't be there if they didn't think they could get good training in before ADCC. Meanwhile, Oleksijuk, he came into the UFC all knockouts. Lost to Ovince Improve Ivan Flew, got Kimura by Jimmy Crute, then went on a little less impressive run, and then most recently knocked out Sam Alvey and Cody Brundage. I believe he was the one who sent Sam Alvey into retirement, wasn't he? But yeah, he's all right. Southpaw, good left straight to the body, good left high kick. And I believe Baraglio goes between, but I saw him doing Southpaw against Petrosian and on the Contender Series. So it could be Southpaw versus Southpaw. We could be in for a bad jabbing matchup with some giggler sweeps, hopefully. Brundage versus Vieira, do not care. Julian Arosa versus Fernando Padilla. This is a bit of a weird one, because they found two dudes who are featherweights with like the same build, just long, gangly guys, both strikers. Arosa, more varied, I'd say, typically, in his striking, but Fernando Padilla, from what I've seen of him, forward-moving, likes to try and overwhelm people, pushes them up against the fence, hits the body and stuff, but just as hittable as Julian Arosa. You know, Julian Arosa, Juicy J, he's a weird one. I think he's already on his third run in the UFC, but he could beat a top 10 guy one day and then get smoked by someone you've never heard of the next, because he is a glass, well, I don't know if he's even a glass cannon, he's a glass masterclass. He's a glass boxer. He does a fantastic job of outstriking people, and then if they chin him, he just goes down. He's been knocked out pretty badly quite a few times. I mean, Caceres caught him really nicely just with that. He threw a left straight, and Arosa was like, yeah, I'm slipping that, and immediately dived his head onto a high kick from the same side. Classic combination, which people were saying that should be a breakout technique of the year, because it was that and Vera versus Cruz and so on. It's older than the hills. You throw your hand knowing that they're going to try and slip it or occasionally parry it. Both of those things mean that they're going straight into the high kick. But yeah, Padilla's interesting because he is, firstly, he's very hittable, but also he hasn't fought in basically 2 years. He got his UFC offer for a fight with Sean Soriano back in October 2021. Couldn't get it because of visa issues, which always means that they got caught streaking somewhere on the and they got put on the sex offenders register for that or something like that. Actually, more often it means that they assaulted someone. But yeah, I mean, this we're almost 2 years later now, or 1.5 years, I'd say. Anything else? Marcus, I'm not talking about heavyweights, even though Jake Collier is there, my favourite heavyweight, because he's just a guy with an eating disorder. His team are like, you're just letting it happen. Josh Quinlan versus Trey Waters is interesting, because I don't know much about Trey Waters. I watched his contender series loss, where he fought Gabriel Bonfim. Now, Bonfim looked pretty good in his last one, but sort of like swinging, awkward striker, not really his forte. And Trey Waters is billed as like the great striker, the lanky, long striker. And he's just flailing all over the place because Bonfim keeps running in on him. But Josh Quinlan, man, this dude, a little bit sketchy. his nickname's Bushido. There you go. That's it in a nutshell. But won his contender series fight with Logan Urban by knocking him out, basically the first punch he threw. So far, so good. Tests positive for drostanolone. So the commission overturned the fight to a no contest, and he pays an $800 fine, which doesn't sound like a lot. I mean, I'd cheat if I wanted to advance my career and it only cost me $800. But, you know, that's your getting into the UFC is off you taking steroids. So it's very weird that the UFC didn't tear up his contract right then, especially with how serious they're supposed to be about USADA. But then they were going to debut him, and that got postponed because he got flagged for pulsing metabolites, but for a different steroid, I believe. He got, that was turinabol, which is the East German oral steroid, which MMA fighters love. So he'd never been caught taking that, but they just said, oh, well, you know, we're being careful about these picograms now. We don't really consider that punishable. So they said he's not cleared to fight. But there's no punishment. So two different steroids already been found in this guy's system. He knocked out Jason Witt in his first UFC performance, basically by single punch again. Yeah, I mean, he's what they want, but he's taken all the roids, or at least two of them. yeah, I mean, if you know of any, like, mitigating circumstances about that, I mean, I'm always willing to hear them and correct myself, but that just looks super shady. And I can't find anything that says, like, oh, he was cleared over this or whatever. It's just that they changed their definition on what was a bad amount of these picograms, but he still had turinabol in his system. Unless they're not different drugs, but that's still like, you know, come on. Why is this guy here? I mean, he's here because we need to fill these fucking cards with contender series slop. Anything else worth noting? Brian Kelleher, he's cool. And that's it. So yeah, that's your lot for this week. But I managed to ramble for a full episode anyway. I'm going to be back on Monday to talk about if anything happened on this card. Then hopefully things start picking up again on the fight schedule. Oh yeah. We got one Johnson versus Marias 3 as well as UFC 288 on the same weekend. And then we got Bellator Musasi versus Edwards. Going to slate that. So yeah, lots of fun stuff coming up. I'm your boy, Jack Slack, you're my boy, and I will catch you on Monday. Cheers. Oh shit, just noticed Charles Johnson's on the card. I like that guy and his stupid hair. Bless.